It is only through a change of consciousness that the world will be transformed. As we bring mind, body, psyche, and spirit into harmony and unity, so also will the world be changed. This is our responsibility as we create and explore new dimensions of being.
And that inaugurates New Dimensions' new theme for the coming months. That's Richard Orban's, an excerpt from Richard Orban's Ritual of the Star Maker, and you can't find it anywhere, so don't look for it.
Go ahead and look for it.
This is Michael Toms.
And Will Nofke.
On behalf of the New Dimensions radio family, and tonight's theme show is Healing the Whole Person, and we have a star-studded lineup of live guests scheduled this evening, and most are here. We have Dr. Irving Oyl, director of the Headlands Institute. We have Alan C. Schiffman, MD. We have James Carter, who's a doctor of optometry in Marin County. We have Dr. Hillary Anderson, a psychologist in private practice here in San Francisco. We have Dr. Kim McKill. We have Ralph Metzner. And we have, and I know I'm going to butcher this one, we have Khaled Al-Faqi. How's that for, we'll try that one.
When we get him here, we'll find out.
Anyway, all of these people represent different perspectives on healing, and we're going to be exploring the whole realm of what healing the whole person is about. And we decided that we would begin tonight's show with Ralph Metzner, who is now located here in San Francisco. And some of you may be familiar with Ralph as the author of Maps of Consciousness and someone who was involved in the early LSD days, and I'm sure Ralph's tired of hearing that, with Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, now Ram Dass. Anyway, I think Ralph has come a long way since those days and is now actively involved in the what's known as the School of Actualism, and is has set up a center here in San Francisco. And Ralph, how do you see healing the whole person?
Okay, I'd like to start by reminding, you know, you and the fact that the word healing and the word wholeness actually have the same root. Healing and health actually means to bring about wholeness. And so the original core meaning of health has to do with wholeness, which we think of as being a process of bringing together parts of the nature, physical, psychic, all parts of nature that are under ordinary conditions splintered off and split off. And this splintering of consciousness is something that is very, very widespread in human consciousness. Just a very simple and widespread obvious example of it is the split that's well known between the emotional nature, the heart and the brain, or between the senses and the brain. So, for example, you have people that are very brain thought dominated, who are out of touch with their sensory nature and out of touch with their emotional nature. These are some of the obvious examples. One could say that a disease process is actually a kind of a splintering in consciousness. It's a breakdown of relationship of the different areas and systems of the body with one another. If you look at the recent research that's been done the last several years on cycles, physiological cycles, there are now some physicians and psychiatric researchers who point out that every single system of the body and mental systems to have their 24-hour cycles, the diurnal cycle. But the 24-hour cycles don't always overlap, and they don't always coincide with the 24-hour cycle of the Earth, as they should. So that, for example, and if you're not aware of that, you may give a person a drug in what you think is the morning, and physiologically that person may be in the middle of the day or evening, and the drug effect may be quite different. And clearly, it becomes, say, if the liver is on one stage of its 24-hour cycle and the kidneys, meantime, are another stage of the 24-hour cycle and the brain maybe on yet a third, this is where a person is obviously going to feel out of sorts. They're going to feel out of phase and out of synchrony. So that would be one way of looking at it. I'd like to present one formula that we have that has been worked out. In actualism stems from Dr. Schofield, who's the founder of the School of Actualism, and I think has, to me, has been very helpful in clarifying my thinking and understanding of this. And this is to look at a progression in health and in disease of three phases, starting with consciousness, going on into function, and finally into structure. So it's a three-phase process that affects both a disease development and a healing development, regardless of which level, whether you're talking whatever kind of health or disease it may be. Now, the last two, the function-structure relationship, is already well understood. For example, we know in all kinds of therapy, it's been recognized for a long time that a disease process will impair function long before it attacks structure. In other words, say you have a liver problem. Liver functioning may be impaired years before it gets to the level of actual liver structural malformation, which is when you pick it up medically. You don't pick it up medically at the level of function. You may just feel lousy. Mm-hmm. You feel malaise, and you know something's wrong. You go to the doctor, he says nothing's wrong. It isn't until it gets to the very late stages of functional impairment and then structural malformation that you pick it up. Okay, now the step before that is consciousness, and I believe that it will be shown, I think it was known in ancient times and will be shown again in the New Age, Aquarian Age, that and increasingly this is happening, that every disease process, not just the so-called psychosomatic diseases, but every disease process without exception has a consciousness factor at the beginning, which may be totally latent. It may not be in the person's awareness at all. In fact, usually isn't. It's something so deeply buried. It's a certain attitude, a state of mind of some sort. Then it proceeds after a long time, if nothing is done to change it, over a long time, and sometimes maybe only after years and years and decades, into function. And then once it's gotten to the function, then the process speeds up more. And then when it gets to structure is when you have the breakdown. So, and the healing process then would also have to go through those same stages in order to be really effective. Now, to simply heal on the structural level, if this is true, is not going to work out. What so often happens is, say a person has a diseased organ finally, well, if they can, what the usual approach is, if you can, you cut it out, you throw it away. If you can't, you put it another instead, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a purely mechanical kind of structural approach. So in a truly preventive holistic medicine, you would work on preventing it by working on ways to in strength and function, and you'd also work on the consciousness aspect. You would have to.
So you'd be treating people while they're well, not necessarily until they get into crisis.
No, by that time, the usual approach of waiting till structure's broken, now that's already an admission that you failed, essentially, or that we failed that are responsible for the health of the
person. But how do you analyze it at the essentially imperceptible level?
Well, it's not imperceptible. It may be, the person may be unaware of it, and they may not be perceiving it themselves, but that's the point. This is where, this is an area of research in consciousness that is now only just being explored. And some avant-garde and pioneering researchers have explored. Now, Reich, for example, got into this, and he pointed out that in cancer, there is a certain state of consciousness that you always find associated with cancer.
I have heard that after a divorce or some...
Well, that's a kind of a trauma, but it's more, it's actually an attitude, a certain attitude, possibly something having to do with fear. Now, there's certain other diseases, perhaps like TB or others, that have a different kind of characteristic attitude. Some people think that in TB it has to do with a kind of a resignation, a kind of a giving up. Person has TB and they kind of give up the fight, they don't fight it. Mm-hmm. That means they don't mobilize the body's own fight processes, so the disease just gradually takes over until it's completely taken over. If a person doesn't have that, this consciousness factor to me is the factor that explains why if two people have the same disease, you may get the same treatment, one recovers and one dies. What's the difference? There's a difference in the way, in the degree to which they are in touch with their own innermost core and can mobilize inner resources to change the consciousness. That
well, the sort of thing that's been naively called the will to live.
The will to live, right, exactly, one aspect of it.
What comes, I think of placebos and the effect that placebos seem to have, and the studies that have been done, the research studies where patients given an actual drug and those given a placebo.
Because in their mind and therefore in their consciousness, they think, you know, that now the healing process is, actually the healing process comes from within anyway, but people are so conditioned and believe that it comes from external, so this way you're actually in a way tricking the mind into, you know, working, getting more in touch with their own inner healing. And science, Christian Science, is in a way on the same track. However, it's going to need more than just the thought. See, Christian Science works on the idea of you just think. You don't give any power to the thought that you have the disease, and you put all the power of thought into saying that you're going to be well. And for some cases, that might work. But for many, it's not enough, in other words. And that's where healing energies come in. In actualism, we work with healing energies, and they are numerous, as we know, gifted natural healers who channel healing energies, who lay on hands on another person, and healing energy just flows through their hands, and they're able to bring about a healing process, which, again, I would say to be really effective, comes from a union between the healer and the patient in consciousness. Then it flows into the functional process, and then it flows finally also into structural repair and structural regeneration or renewal.
Reminds me of recently they had Jack Schwartz. They were testing Jack Schwartz here at Langley Porter, and they were testing him for his healing powers with other people, and they found that his brainwave patterns would match up to the person he was working with.
Person, right. Yeah, it's a unification in the work that we do, where we teach, essentially we teach people to heal themselves, although we do also do some body work. This union in consciousness is the first thing, so that you're not actually doing anything to somebody or on somebody so much as you're doing it with them. You're putting yourself into an alliance with the healing potential, what we call the physician within. The physician within of the two people would then come into a union in consciousness and then work from within the one person, with the healer being able to channel energy in a more powerful way. Then the healer, of course, has to be aware of the fact and be careful that he keeps processing and eliminating the negative or disease-type energy that is being brought up or that's involved. Otherwise, he himself will pick up tremendous psychic loads from the patient, as has been shown even in the Kirlian photographs, where you see the healer's aura after a healing session is all debilitated and messed up. So that unless the healer knows, is aware of this tendency and has a way to counteract it, you know, he himself can get sick. And many healers, I mean, shamanistic healers, for example, will go through elaborate types of procedures to rid themselves. Sometimes taking a purgative to throw up after a healing session, you know, just to get rid of the toxin that they might have inadvertently taken on.
Is actualism primarily a process to develop healers?
No, not necessarily. Not primarily. That's one aspect, and actually, in the actualism training program, that's sort of the first stage in which we train people to tap into healing energies within their own nature that they can use primarily for self-healing and healing with each other and that kind of thing. Then, after that, because we feel that's the in any process of growth and development, personal growth and development, the first step has to be a sound body, a body that's responsive to higher frequency energies. Then after the healing is brought into, and the body is brought to a higher sensitivity of response, then other kinds of energy work involving mental work, creativity, other areas of personality change and transformation can be brought in. But the healing we feel is, you know, primary. But we don't really make the separation of just healing the body. For example, healing energies are very closely involved in interpersonal relationships. And that's why so very often people, if there's an interpersonal relationship problem, it affects the emotional nature, which will affect then the glandular nature, the endocrine system, and therefore the body, the heart, the liver, the entire body system is immediately affected. In other people, it's more perhaps the nervous system will be affected depending on body type and which area of the body is the most sensitized or the most vulnerable. And that's another area, I think, where a fruitful area of research or discovery in the future will be that there are certain personality types that are prone to or particularly vulnerable to certain particular types of disease processes. Again, going through the whole consciousness function and structure. And I've done a little bit of research in that, and as others have too, in terms of, for example, astrological types and that kind of thing. Areas of the body that
correlated that or not.
Right, that are vulnerable, and it shows up in the horoscope, amazingly enough.
We're going to be continuing our discussion of healing the whole person, and we'll be right back in just a minute.
Okay, we're back, I think.
We're back.
Okay. Get it. My headphones were not operable for a minute.
And James Carter's with us and Hillary Anderson.
Yeah. Josh, I can't call you James.
It does sound a lot softer, doesn't it?
Yeah. And also Hillary Anderson.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Hillary. Josh is a practicing optometrist in Fairfax, who is also into iridology, and we're going to be finding out something about that. And Hillary is a practicing psychologist in San Francisco, as well as being academic dean at the California Institute of Asian Studies, among other things. And Josh, iridology certainly relates to healing the whole person. I wonder how does it relate?
Well, in a very graphic way, and
You can see that anytime you look. And the iris is a beautiful picture of the workings of the whole body. And when we're talking about holistic health, when we're talking about the whole, we're talking about, in a way, more than just isolated systems or organs. We're talking about even beyond the nature of just the physical organs and systems. We're talking about the emotional being, the social being, and many other beings that operate simultaneously. And the iris has a way of presenting itself as a panel, as a readout panel on the history that the body has experienced. And as Ralph so clearly put before, that most disease as we know it is a conflict, is a crisis in consciousness, is a crisis in body. We see also through the workings and the malfunctions of these areas of the bodies, these crises and these conflicts on other levels, on emotional levels and other levels that we can't normally see when we first look at our own workings of our body, such as the workings of the blood, and we see a glucose tolerance test and we get readings out, and that doesn't really tell us about, say, the conflict in consciousness. It tells us that there's an upset possibly in function, possibly in structure. But we know that simultaneously that we've got certain crises on more subtler levels. And as I've been seeing patients over the years, I've been seeing a progression similar to what Ralph is talking about in the School of Actualism in a little different way. And that is that I see disease going from this conflict, going from a subtle to a gross stage. That we do start out with imperceptible change. We do start out with a conflict that usually does skip by our waking state consciousness. And we usually see it as a choice, as a decision point that we see in one of the more subtler bodies, in the mental body or the emotional body. And as the being experiences this upset and doesn't handle it gets progressively more and more gross. Obviously, the grossest form of disease is death when the conflict is so overwhelming that we actually have a crisis that is beyond survival. And usually we see this progression take characteristic stages. And as I've been seeing this, I usually see mental imbalances, such as attitudes, thoughts, ideas. Usually these arise, belief structures. These are mental constructs which create patterns of conflict within consciousness. Usually these can be resolved with a little clarity, a little wisdom. Sometimes just throwing it out as that was all craziness on the mental level. Oftentimes this is not the case, and we have to progress to a more grosser level rather. And this usually involves the relationship with the person to another being. And this is where the emotional body comes in. And we start getting patterns of behavior, and the disease is now becoming more gross. We get attitudes that now have emotional counterparts. We start getting a little resentment. Maybe we get a little fear, a little doubt, a certain kinds of forms of depression. And these are something that now we can kind of see, and other people can see too, and they may give feedback. That's something that is kind of gone beyond one step, beyond just the mental body. And sometimes this can be thrown off also. The emotional conflict can sometimes come to a head purely on the emotional level and be clarified, again, by communication, usually with another person. This emotional harmony that is a nourishing ground for harmony with the higher beings.
What about someone who's really in physical pain, is having severe physical pain?
Okay, here we've got a progression that has gone obviously to a grosser level. It's gone beyond the mental, it's gone beyond the emotional. It has to get so gross that the organ systems say, well, because of this conflict, we're going to have to turn this organ up and maybe this one down, and let's turn the secretions of this organ over about twofold and turn this one down. So
this guy shapes up, is that the idea?
Shapes up or ships out in a way. And this is where we can see disease is actually a message in a way, something beyond just a simple saying that our disease is a call to consciousness. It's something beyond that. It's saying that we have a need, and there's an unmet need. And this is where the whole healing process begins, is handling unmet need. And in our professional schools as doctors, we're all taught that that is our key purpose in our profession, is to take care of unmet need. Well, we've usually gotten so far away from really clearly seeing what need really is and what it takes to fulfill a need. We're usually into the replacement theory of organ systems, or replacing functions. If we don't have that gland working, well, let's just make it look like it works by putting in insulin. Or let's make it appear that there's no problem there by removing the gland and say that the body can still make it because it seems all right. And so the person who is usually in tremendous amounts of pain is going through a more serious conflict. And the call is much more beyond that, which you would just get on a mental and emotional level. And the call is met by resources, by compassion, sometimes by gross physical intervention. If you've got somebody who has a serious kind of infectious state or an injury or a broken bone, then it needs attention by another person. And that person has to stop what he's doing. I've seen this time and again where the disease may be very painful. Somebody who's walking down the street, totally healthy, and all of a sudden they find themselves inside of a manhole and they wonder what was going on. Well, it seems rather simplistic at the outset, but if you really penetrate most of these situations, you usually find that the crisis was actually there on subtler levels before the physical counterpart took place, even though it appeared to be just an accident or somebody else tripped them or there was something there that shouldn't have been there. Accidents are even even further beyond the state of some of these more subtler levels. And usually this call to consciousness can be really, really strengthened. The healing process can really be strengthened from within when the being really sees that they are in charge and that the disease process was something that they're perpetuating at their own expense.
This relationship between emotions and the physical, I'm wondering how have you seen that relationship, Hillary, in counseling people? Have you seen people who have, say, had emotional problems develop physical manifestations of that problem? Or?
Yeah, I see people coming to me usually have some kind of upset in their emotional life, though, for the most part. And I don't see the serious dysfunction in the physical so much. I mean, they would probably go to someone else for that. But I do see persons nervously distraught, you might say, and coming to me quite disturbed on certain levels, you know. Usually it's a problem of relationship. Or they just might come to me and really wonder what it's all about and how can I straighten some things out. And then I go about oftentimes using these focus techniques that we've talked about before. The Tao and the I Ching I use quite a bit in my own work, which are, you might say, oracular techniques or techniques by which the person and myself will go through a questioning session, and then I will find out what is deeply somehow the real question in the life, and then through the process of what we might call an ancient system of divination, we'll work on some particular issue in the life that seems to be disturbing them the most. But the physical disturbance, not so much. I don't get that. It's not at that level when they come to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, when these problems are on emotional levels, that's where people who do take that responsibility do search out for the need to solve their problem before it does get gross. And this is really what we're searching for, is to get people to do take that responsibility and say that there is a crisis in my emotional being and in my consciousness, and maybe we can handle this. I don't want to get too far along. I know people go crazy and get institutionalized. Well, that's starting to get into certain kinds of physical functional ability, too.
Well, so often we think of the healing process as purely related to the physical, and it's so much more than that. Seems.
Yeah, I would say even in people that go into therapy, they may not mention it. You know, when I did psychotherapy, when a person goes to a psychologist, or they may not mention their physical symptoms. They feel as if it's the wrong department. You know, after the session, they may go down the hall to the ND, you know,
right,
and tell him about it. But it's obviously nature doesn't make that distinction; that the person's making that. And so there's no department of psychiatry or psychology in nature. It's all interlinked, you know. And so the person who has certain emotional interrelationship problems may also be suffering, and usually is, from physical symptoms, whether it's constipation or headaches or indigestion or difficulty in breathing. Almost always goes along with that. Again, Reich was a pioneer in that area. He He saw that very clearly, and that's why he worked almost simultaneously on the body. You know, he was unlike Freud, who was content to sit there and let the patient pre-associate without looking at the patient. That was a crucial difference between Reich and Freud. Freud didn't like to look at the patient. He sat behind him, so the patient couldn't see him and he couldn't see him. They couldn't see each other. And it was just free association, the mind. Well, Reich said, well, I don't want to do this. I want to see what's going on with this person's body. So he turned his chair around and looked right at him. And then lo and behold, as he looked at it and he'd see the person talking about his emotional conflicts, he'd see the body going through all these things. Mm-hmm. And he'd see the breathing would be like constricted, like the person couldn't breathe. So then he'd put his hand on the body and try to loosen up the breathing, and lo and behold, the emotions felt better and different. You know? And so there you got the beginnings of that whole bioenergetic approach, which has been developed since then.
This is something we've seen in Chinese medicine historically for thousands of years. Typically, the old Chinese doctor was a physician who lived with his patients. Indeed, how could he attempt to care for his patients if he wasn't aware of their environment, their home environment, their relationship with their diet, or the relationship with their seasons? How can you separate a man from that which so often surrounds them? You can't take them out and put them in a box and poke them into certain ways and expect that this is going to give them an awareness of how they can take care of themselves when they do get back into the world. So much of even the fractioning that we have in our current therapies is such that we take care of, say, a mental aspect or an emotional aspect, or I'm just your liver doctor and I'll take care of your gallbladder, but you can leave I don't do diabetes at all. And indeed, we have patients who'll say, do anything to get rid of my sciatica, but leave my diabetes alone because I've got a good relationship with it. Well, we've got to go much more beyond that and see that the relationship is much more extensive.
The medical profession itself has tended towards specialization and away from the old general practitioner of the old days.
Well, I think a lot of that is because the medical profession is seeing that really there is a lot to know, and that that the conventional way is to focus. And when you focus,
you've got to get the medical profession in here. I feel that Irving Oyl has something to contribute at this point, so we really ought to get...
But I'd like to just add one thing in terms of the Chinese, which I always was such, to me, such a beautiful indication of their attitude, where, as you know, the in the classical Chinese, the barefoot doctors, as they were known, would be paid by their patients to keep them well. In other words, it was like a subscription-type thing. You paid them while you were well, and if you got sick, they treated you free, or you know, even reimbursed you for the mistake that they had made.
Well, in a way, we've kind of gone to the same place right now with some of our malpractice.
Yes, in a way, right, and insurance, I suppose, yeah, group insurance type things. But I think it's a trend in the right direction. It moves then more into the preventive thing and the tune-ups, whether it's your tune-ups with needles or whatever approach you use, tuning the system.
We're going to come right back. Oh, that's better. We've been joined by Dr. Irving Oyl, and it's nice to have you here with us, Irving.
Thank you.
Irving had, as I understand it, a thriving medical practice in New York for many years, and then one day started a free clinic in New York City, and eventually made your way to Bolinas, and that's where you started the Headlands Clinic.
Right, okay.
And I know that you've been actively involved in researching alternative and new ways of healing, and I felt the urge to get a medical doctor in here with the way the discussion was going.
Well, I'm not too happy about the term alternative methods of healing. I think this is the direction that medicine is going, and I like to think of it in terms of recent advances in the healing profession, you know.
The natural progression.
It's the natural growth of the healing arts, you know, which started way back with Hippocrates and people like that. So it's taken another step. What I've been doing for the past about 5 years is sort of researching on my own, just to satisfy myself, to see what it is that actually is responsible for healing in people. And we looked into various and sundry things, biofeedback, visual imagery, acupuncture with high-frequency sound, looking for something that will tie the whole thing together, which... it seems to be like some of the discussion was about patients' attitude is what's responsible for their disease. And it seems I would say that the patient's attitude is a large factor, that we make the mistake of thinking we're treating a disease or a body. Now, there's a certain presumption that's made there, which is a kind of a world that's flat presumption. See, we have not one shred of proof that there is such a thing as a physical body. You're just looking at me.
I'm just waiting
for you to expand on that statement.
Well, I mean, this goes back to Immanuel Kant, who suggests that time and space are figments of our imagination. It's entirely possible that the whole thing is happening on the back of your eyeballs, that there isn't anybody out there but you, and you're making the whole thing up. That's a good possibility. We're hung on the Cartesian presumption that there is a real physical world, which we have to adapt to by means of our mental and emotional apparatus. Now, that's a shaky presumption at best.
Well, that sounds very similar to the Hindu Maya, the world is illusion.
Yeah, yeah.
The old comic saying, it not matter, it energy.
Or that perhaps, if you go back to Einstein, who suggested that matter and energy are two aspects of a single phenomenon. And what the Hindus and the Buddhists are suggesting is that mind, energy, and matter are three aspects of a single phenomenon, sort of a trinity. And we've been, for the last 200-300 years, hung up on manipulating matter. You know, that's since Newtonian physics, but I think most of the people in the healing professions never caught up to Albert Einstein, you know, who suggested that energy and matter are a single entity. So perhaps if we're looking to get what we call healing, that we can interfere on the energy level as well as on the consciousness level. That's what gets you into your acupuncture thing. And if you interfere on the consciousness level, like when I say you have to consider the fact that there really is nothing out there, that requires a huge change in consciousness.
Yeah. Well, that's what this show is about, ostensibly.
Well, that's the way you introduced it.
Right.
But this is the practical application of it. That, in terms of treating patients, we've always been told that you have to treat an actual organic disease, that you have to make the patient feel better. Well, it almost doesn't matter whether he feels better or not. You have to get some definite evidence, let's say laboratory evidence, that the disease is gone. Let's say in some of these talks about the pain-relieving ability of acupuncture, there was an article in Medical World News about a year ago in which some eminent American authorities discussed their feelings about what was happening with acupuncture anesthesia. And a lot of them are saying, well, it's just hypnosis. You know, you're hypnotizing the patient. So what they're presuming is that if you do acupuncture and the patient feels no pain, that doesn't mean that the pain isn't there, that the pain is still there even though there's nobody there who feels it. That's essentially the argument they're making, that we have to concern ourselves with organic disease. And what I'm suggesting now is that all we have to concern ourselves is what the patient thinks he has. That we have really no right to say, it doesn't matter what you think you have, I know what you've got.
What kind of training is happening in medical school for that right now?
There is a movement within the medical profession to use this approach, to use the so-called mind over matter approach. And Carl Jung, of course, was into this whole trip with his method of active imagination, in which he suggested that he was an alchemist, and he suggests that one of the things that you talk about with converting lead into gold is that the lead and the gold are the same thing. Now, if you say the lead is the physical symptom, the thing that the patient comes into you complaining about, we've been taught that our purpose is to suppress the symptom. But perhaps what we have to do is to convert that this energy in the symptom, with its polarity reversed, becomes the cure. It is the cure. So you don't really want to suppress it. You want to change its polarity. And he came up with a method. That's one of the methods we've been researching. That's the trip in that healing mind thing.
Which is interesting because it ties back into the homeopathic approach rather than the allopathic. Because that's what the homeopaths say. You don't knock out the disease with a counter agent, but you put something into the body that simulates the disease in order, therefore, to mobilize the body's own.
It's a bit of the hair of the dog that bit you approach. Mm-hmm. It's like taking a little nip in the morning to get over a hangover. That's essentially a homeopathic approach. But the thing that we've been working with is converting the symptom into a mental image. And the symptom becomes a mental image, and then you talk to this mental image, and it tells you what you're doing wrong. A figment of your imagination.
That's what we would call tuning into the consciousness of it. In other words, what is the signal? What is the symptom saying? It's a signal from the body that something is off. What is that signal? Tune into it, listen into it, look at it, get the message from it, rather than knocking out the message, which is the usual approach.
Right. The simplest example is suppose I had a patient who had a pain in his buttock, right? And I would do an examination, and I would see that the reason he has a pain in his buttock is because he's sitting on a tack. So using the current medical approach, I would give him a quarter or a half a grain of morphine every 3 or 4 hours, or maybe Percodan or codeine, and allow him to continue to sit on the tack. That's essentially what we do. So what we have to do is to get people up off their rear ends and off the tack and understand that if they have a symptom, it's trying to tell them something.
You mentioned the imagery. How do you do that? You have techniques for getting the patient into that
space? Yeah. Well, okay, we'll just start at the end. What I do, I use the acupuncture system to induce the alpha state, which is a state in which the patient stops thinking. You know, they're not thinking anymore. And when you're not thinking, you can... what I tell them to do, I'll first get them to stop thinking and put them through a thing of where they're breathing, raise their oxygen content so they feel better. Then I suggest that they imagine themselves in a very beautiful place. This works especially well with meditators, with artists, people whose feminine side is well-developed, who can make images. And what I'll tell them to do is just imagine yourself in a beautiful place and hang out there. And then you'll see somebody. You'll see some living creature, either an animal or a person. And then you greet the animal or the person. You make friends with them. It's guided imagery. And then you ask them if they know about your illness. And it always tells them. Tells them what they're doing wrong and what the message is. It always tells
them. Very concise. Very simple.
Well, it's got to be simple. I did general practice for a lot of years. And when you're seeing 20... Well, I spoke to a doctor from Holland today who tells me he sees 40 patients a day. But if you're seeing a lot of patients during the day, it's absolutely essential for a general practitioner to have a method which is efficient, quick, and simple. And this really works very well. We've done, I'm doing an experiment in Santa Cruz where we're using a tuning fork on the acupuncture points instead of needles or high-frequency sound. And... we're getting 95% results. Doesn't matter what they have, and it takes only 4 visits on the outside.
You hang the fork and then hold it on the point.
We'd have to get into the whole thing as to what's going on in the acupuncture system. But essentially, that's what 3 hits with a tuning fork, and they get stoned, and they're able to. Yeah, and they sometimes.
And it's legal.
I don't see how you can pass a law against a tuning fork.
They're going
to try. And when I say stoned, the EEG equivalent of being stoned, in this case, the ones I'm talking about, are going into the alpha state. And then you tell them to make the picture, and it works. The thing always tells them what they've been doing, what they've been doing wrong.
Does that awareness then proceed to cure the symptoms?
Oh, yeah. In 85% of the cases, the symptom disappears. What they'll do is... I did a thing at the Santa Cruz Health Department. They asked me to come down and demonstrate this technique for the mental health people. And we had, there was one young woman there who'd been under treatment. This is a very simple. Who'd been under treatment for 4 years for cancer phobia. She was sure she had cancer, and they'd been doing whatever else they thought they could do. And I'd asked them to get me people who were either into meditation or good visualizers. And, I hit her with the tuning fork, laid her down on the thing, and I said, imagine yourself in a beautiful place. And she was a good visualizer. And she said, okay, I'm there. And I said, now, look around. This was in a forest. I imagined myself in a forest, and she described the forest and the path. And she says, oh, look, I see a deer. And I said, find out his name. And she found out the deer's name was a female. And I said, ask the deer about your cancer. And she asked the deer, and the answer came back into her head. And the deer said, don't be stupid. You don't have cancer. And that was it. She said, okay, I believe the deer. And then about 3 days later, I got a call from the Commissioner of Health telling me, you know, you really upset some of our department heads. They're worried they're going to be replaced by a deer. But the visual image, the animal, again, this is Jung's technique, the animal that you see, the hallucination that you see on the back of your eyeballs with your eyes closed. At Menninger, Elmer and Alice Green call this technique theta reverie. There's apparently some connection between theta wave states and the visual image. And they call it theta reverie. You just convert the symptom into a creature, and you ask the creature, why are you doing this to me? And they always tell you, you're running around too much, I don't like your husband, or, and you have to work it out with them. See, then they get into, and what the treatment consists of is a discussion between the person, I guess you would call it the ego state, you know, for lack of a better term, and the other side of them. Now, sometimes it's an argument between the male side of the person and the female side, the one that's got to go out into the world and earn a living and do all that, and the one that just wants to lay around and have a good time. And they argue, you know, people get that when they get up in the morning. Got to get up now, and I don't feel like getting up. I think I'll sleep a little later. And then the other side paralyzes you so you can't move. And what it will do, apparently, this gets into the whole split brain hypothesis, that each one of us is actually two different people. And that the disease is a conflict. Well, each one of us is actually four different people. And the disease is a conflict between either of those two pairs of opposites, where male as opposed to female, and civilized, urban, 20th century human, as opposed to Cro-Magnon man, 30,000 years old, you know, which is the primitive state. And they're always balancing off against each other. So if you repress a primitive drive, or if you repress your feminine side or your masculine side, it gets back at you through the body. And that's usually what the symptom is. I've had people with headaches tell me, boy, she really kicked me in the head today. Instead of saying they have a headache, mm-hmm. instead of talking in terms of pathology, we talk in terms of messages, so that the so-called disease becomes something positive and not negative, which immediately changes the polarity.
This makes it a little clearer when you understand that there's a good possibility that there is no such thing as disease.
Oh, I don't accept that there's such a thing as disease. I don't really believe that. I mean, as soon as we put a negative aspect to it, that's responsible for a lot of our trouble.
Yeah, neither in acupuncture nor in homeopathy do they work with diseases as entities at all.
That's right. They talk about disharmonies.
Disharmonies between energy meridians, and in homeopathy, you just look at symptoms.
Right.
They look at the pattern, the gestalt made by the symptoms, and then try to duplicate that with a plant or an herb in order to then induce the body to itself to bring about the counteracting pattern, rather than throwing in a counteracting drug.
Well, there's an interesting thing about that. You know, the body, it's a fantastic machine, and I think that healing is something that we have to actively inhibit. We're into a bag of, you have to cause it. You have to do it for somebody. I have to heal you, or you have to heal yourself. When essentially all you have to do is get out of the way, mm-hmm. and permit the healing to take place. And the body works that in a lot of works like that in a lot of ways, where there are inhibitory processes, which by simply releasing the inhibition, the cramp, the body flows and runs normally.
And this spontaneous action can be very dramatic on a symptomatic level. You can have a very, very serious disease, a life-threatening disease, and sometimes get spontaneous remissions of those diseases. And it's very exciting to participate in those. And,
yeah.
and you really realize that, in a way, you're not healing the patient. The patient is really taking care
of
himself.
Well, I think we have to understand that none of us actually does any healing. It seems like almost arrogance to think that we heal anybody or cure anybody. All we do is set up the conditions under which healing takes place.
However, that releasing of those inhibitors and blocks to letting the healing capabilities from within come through is not always that easy.
No. Yeah.
Sometimes it's easy, and when it is, it's dramatic, you know, and then other times the conditioning has been set in such a powerful way and has been so chronic for such a long time that it's It requires...
It's possible that it's as easy or as difficult as you expect it to be. I mean, it may be that we're making the whole thing up.
I mean, I'm enchanted by all this positiveness, but will someone tell me what death is?
Birth. Death is birth.
All right. In relation to the body?
Let me give you the archetypal example of human birth. Take a fetus at term, 9 months. Now, what have you got? You've got a water-dwelling animal, water-dwelling creature, attached by a stalk to a nourishing soil, which for 9 months has been pumping blood in. And what do you do at birth? Except you let out the water, you rip out the root, and you fling it out into an alien atmosphere. That's death.
It's the next step.
All right.
It's the other side. I don't think you can differentiate between the two. And that's one of the other things that disease, what we call disease, is probably, insofar as we control it, disease is probably a refusal to be reborn. And in order to be healed, you have to be reborn into a new state of consciousness. I think you mentioned that, Josh. As disease as a call to higher consciousness. So I would definitely agree with that. That when I see somebody who's really sick, I look and see, well, what is it preventing you from doing, you know? How does this disease change your life? Because the disease that you get points a direction in which you have to go.
I had a dramatic experience in my own self in my last year at the University of California. And here I was going to be graduating, get with my degree, and will have understood the nature of the disease process from the academic point of view of symptoms and so on, and yet really didn't understand the true nature of disease. And I contacted hepatitis. It's a pretty serious case. And my mother had found out about that, and she contacted this healer in London named George Chapman and arranged this meditation, he in Aylesbury in England and myself in Berkeley. And during this meditation, of which I had no preconceived notions about, indeed I only had about a half hour of energy in the day where I could actually sit up and be wheeled around or given food or drink molasses and milk or what have you, and was tremendously jaundiced and yellow and so on. And so I sat up in bed that night at 10 o'clock and just passively just said, okay, whatever, and had no direction except just to begin a meditation. And a whole process of consciousness, of visualization, came through me. And I began to see the whole origins of the condition and the things that I needed to do. No direction. Indeed, it was almost as if I was catapulted from one stage to the other. There was no initiation on my part. It seemed like there was just, you could say, grace, or there was just energy that was taking me to the next step. And I understood how I got the disease, what I was doing to myself to perpetuate it in the world, what kind of people that I attracted to perpetuate that condition, what I need to do to avoid its recurrence in the future, what furthered for me to learn from this so that I may help others, what, and it just continued and continued. It ended up in...
All these thoughts just came to you?
Just spontaneously. It ended in this vision of Christ, which I had no... it just appeared. And then I went to sleep. That signaled the end of the meditation. And I went to sleep that night, and the next morning I just got up out of bed. I felt like it's time to get up. It's pretty sunny outside.
That's something you can do consciously and deliberately. Exactly what happened to you, I find it's possible to induce that state in
yes, people. In waking state consciousness.
Yeah, if they're willing to heed the call, you know, because right. the illness always gets you to stop whatever it is you're doing.
Well, this is where the role of the doctor is the facilitator to harmonize with that spark and to help initiate that spark.
Well, it seems that humans have always required some sort of a ritual and somebody to administer the ritual, you know. I think the doctor or the guru or whoever it is just gives you permission to heal yourself.
Yeah.
If he can just give you permission and maybe show you the way, you know, to do what you did.
It's like you're on the ladder and somebody says, oh, come on, don't be so foolish, come on. And you say, okay. And you just take the next step.
This is KQED-FM in San Francisco, 88.5 on your FM dial. You're listening to New Dimensions, and tonight we're exploring healing the whole person. And you've been listening to Irving Oyl and Josh Carter, Ralph Metzner and Hillary Anderson. And we're going to be joined in a few minutes by Kim McKell and Ellen Schiffman. And we're going to be doing the next few minutes a calendar portion. So we'll be back with Healing the Whole Person in about 5 minutes.